Yeah, I would like to start, my presentation is on epistemic communities, courts, and the democratic shaping of patent law, and why are epistemic communities so important. I will start with two quotes. The first is by Julia Black, who quite some time ago already recognized that the patent system in particular is striking in its closure and its resistance to external interventions. And from the perspective of sociology of law, it's very often stated that those involved in the practice of law interpret, redefine, recreate, and reconstitute the meaning of law in particular. So the law community seems to have an impact of what's done in law, but modern democratic societies are based on an ideal type of separation of powers. The legislator is meant to set the norms, which are then executed and enforced by the executive branch of government and also by the administration, and finally interpreted by the law. So there's a relationship between checks and balances between those three branches of government, at least in the democratic legal theory. So in my talk, I will first define a little bit the epistemic community of the patent system, and then apply the concept to biotech patents. And I will explore how the different arenas of decision making, the administrative, the legislative, or judicial arena, has an impact and has an inherent logics, which then has an effect in real world practice. And in my last section, I will have a case study on patents on human embryonic stem cells and will show you how nowadays the laws which are enshrined and practiced at the European level, how they are dealt with in legal practice at the European Patent Office. So first of all, for the definition, an epistemic community, as defined by Ernst Haas, is a network of professionals with recognized expertise and competence in a particular domain and an authoritative claim to policy-relevant knowledge within that domain or issue area. So what distinguishes an epistemic community from a profession or a network is that a profession might be considered a subcategory of an epistemic community. You may know about the sociology of professions by Eliot Fraidson, and he said that professions have a certain license and societal mandate. They are mostly self-controlled, and they have a high social prestige, high reputation. They are they enjoy social appreciation and a high income, and they, in a way, regulate themselves because they are a certain profession. But in an epistemic community, you don't have a single profession, but often several professions. So a profession is but a subcategory of an epistemic community. But an epistemic community is also more than just a network, because an epistemic community is held together by strong cognitive and normative bonds. So the members of the patent epistemic community are made up by patent offices staff, examiners, and the members of the boards of appeal, patent attorneys, patent judges at specialized patent courts, also staff of international patent organizations such as the WIPO, patent academics, public servants and ministries, but also members of technology transfer institutes. So it's quite a transnational community, but it's made up mostly by technicians, which means by engineers, scientists, and lawyers. And you can recognize some shared cognitive beliefs of the patent epistemic community. They tend to believe that patent law is a neutral thing. So they think that patent law is continually a neutral, inert system which is above or beyond ethics, politics, and cultural concerns. And this image extends not only to the belief in the neutrality of the patent regime, but also to the idea that technical invention is itself intrinsically uncontroversial. They also think that patent law is boosting research and development, and at the same time, innovation is somehow equated with social progress. And patent law is considered to be a unitary law. So they think there is no need for technical specification. The thing is that they think one size fits all. And the assumption is also that there's a narrow and positive correlation between patents and innovative capacity. So in a certain way, they think patents are good for innovation. So if you have more patents, it's even better for innovation. So the epistemic community has a common policy enterprise which is directed towards strengthening patent law. The expansion of the intellectual property system is seen as irreversible and also as necessary in a globalized competitive economy. And exclusions from patentability are considered as almost unadmissible, and it's always said that exclusions have to be kept very narrow. So how has the patent system been governed over the last decades? It has been governed mainly within the administrative arena, which means by interaction between applicants as represented by patent attorneys and patent offices. And in addition, the judicial arena also played a role, and the legal evolution of the patent system has mostly happened through case law, either by the boards of appeal of the EPO or by specialized patent courts at the national level. So in that respect, the direction and pace of legal development is mostly driven by the patent applicants. I try to explain this development by this left-hand side graph. So you can say economic competitors may pull to certain directions, and they may try to limit the scope of the patent claims of their competitors. But all together, they are speeding ahead, and they are somehow trying to push the patent system towards its expansion. And there's hardly any vector which points to a different direction, which tries to limit the scope or the limit the expansion of patent law. So institutionalized counteractors which could act against this proceeding ahead and which would pull in a different direction or strive for limits and boundaries to patent protection have not been very very much existing for a long time, for decades in patent law, in the patent system. So as many observers have summed up, patent applicants, patent attorneys, examiners, and judges have formed an epistemic community which works, according to Peter Drohos, with a set of assumptions, understandings, conventions, and values that settles issues and problems of interpretation within the patent system. And by doing so, the patent community probably exercises more influence on the direction and content of patent policy than legislators, which in any case rely on committees or specialists to advise them on matters of patent policy. So in a certain way, what James Boyle said, they employ a pro-patent bias, and in case of doubt, they always say, you better grant a patent than to not grant a patent or revoke a patent. And the European Patent Office which is supposed to act in the public interest is, according to some observers, more inclined to be captured by its clients, so to serve their needs and their wishes and desires, and not to control them. So, this happened until the 1990s, but then when the biotech directive was drafted, the patent biotech patents entered the legislative arena, and the legislative arena is a more complex arena. It's made up of different institutions, the Commission, the Council, and the Parliament, and particularly the Parliament proved to be more responsive to different stakeholders, and also civil society actors emerged and became highly vocal in opposing so-called patents on life. So you can say that the EU Biotech Directive was a certain break with the traditional governance of patent law. And the Parliament was very much responsive to concerns about ethical limits to patent eligibility. It was also concerned and focused on the erosion of the public domain of open science and about public health concerns, and also admitted doubts about the efficiency of patents for innovation and economy. So what was focused and expressed was concerns about the transaction costs, about patent tickets and royalty stacking. So it was questioned whether the equation more patents is more innovation is really helpful and true and empirically correct. So in their legal, in passing the directive, the ordre public exclusions were emphasized and broadened, and in some national implementation processes, some nation states even emphasized and inscribed more limits to patentability. For instance, in France and Switzerland, they banned natural genes as such. Embryonic stem cells were banned for patentability in Switzerland and Italy. And in Italy, even genetic screenings, which may result in social discrimination, were deemed to be non-patentable. And several jurisdictions also said that human dignity and human rights would form moral norms, so they should also be a boundary to patentability. And what's remarkable is that these provisions even had a preventive and preemptive logics and purpose, and they tried to incentivize R&D on harmful knowledge or technology which has been deemed ethically problematic. So in the European Biotech Directive in Article 6, a number of exclusions and non-exhaustive list of exceptions to patentability was passed. You know the list, it's about cloning of human beings, the germline modification, the uses of human embryo for industrial and commercial purposes, and also a trade-off between the health of animals and the medical benefit to humans. So another article was Article 5 of the Biotech Directive, which emphasized on the special status of the human body. So what happened to these provisions, legislative provisions, now in the judicial arena? I will have a look at two more recent decisions of the Court of Justice of the European Union. The first case is the famous case Brüstle versus Greenpeace, and here the court decided for a very broad interpretation of the ordre public clause in Article 6 and thus in the exclusions from patentability. They employed a very broad definition of the human embryo, saying the human embryo is not only a human ovum after fertilization, but also an embryo which is created by cloning processes, by SCMT, and also a partner node which is somehow triggered to resemble an embryo, I would say, was also considered to be to fall under this broad definition of a human embryo. The court also employed a very broad definition of the term use. Use also covered purposes for scientific research, and they also employed the so-called whole teaching approach, which means that you don't have to look at the claims only, but also at the description. And whenever the technical teaching requires the prior destruction of a human embryo or their use as base material, this has also has to be excluded from patentability. In a second, more recent case, International Stem Cell Corporation versus Controller General of Patents, Designs and Trademarks, the judgment in a certain way narrowed down this broad definition for a human embryo and stated that partner nodes do not constitute a human embryo. So for the definition of a human embryo, there has to be an inherent capacity of developing into a human being. And it's a matter for the National Court then to determine whether the patent should be granted or not be granted. So, in a more general conclusion, we can say that we have to distinguish specialist versus generalist courts. Specialist courts, which means patent courts, or the technical boards of appeal of the EPO, are more inclined to have a formal or tunnel vision, as Fambisetti stated, on patentability issues, whereas generalist appellate courts seem to apply a broader perspective on the issues at stake. Some scholars say that there's an emergent constitutionalization of patent law, and fundamental rights do have to play a role and are playing a role in the jurisdiction and in the judgments of those general courts. And this is also expressed by a quote from the Advocate General Yves Bott, who said that the European Union is not only a market to be regulated, but also has values to be expressed, and dignity, human dignity and human rights should be considered when judging on patentability issues. But the question remains, how are we to deal with moral pluralism? Because in Europe there are different national norms and national legislation with respect to embryo research, for instance. Should there be a European ordre public, or should decisions be left to national discretion? This is an open question. I won't be able to respond to it adequately, but I think it's something which needs to be remarked. So in my last part, what I will try to do is to explore how the European Patent Office, and thus the administrative arena, has reacted to these legislative and ECJ judgments. In some decisions, the Edinburgh case and also the Wharf case, this very much followed the very same line in saying that wherever there is a method which necessarily involved the destruction of a human embryo, this is excluded from patentability. However, there is a more recent judgment. Maybe most of you won't know about this, but after for patents which were filed after January of 2008, the EPO is allowing patents which rely on embryonic stem cells, because they say there is now a technology or technique available which allows for the provision of human embryonic stem cell cultures without destroying a human embryo in any production step. And the paper they refer to for making this new decision is this paper by Yang Chang and others, which claims to have created embryonic stem cells without embryo destruction. And you can see now what they did in their experiments. They had 41, eight cell stage embryos, and they used them, and they got 5 embryonic stem cell lines. They did 3 groups of experiments. In the first 2 groups, they also added embryonic stem cell cultures, and in the third group, they employed a new method, and they used 2 embryos, and they say they got 1 embryonic stem cell line without co-culturing them with previously available human embryonic stem cell cultures. So the question is whether the Chang method has really changed the field of human embryonic stem cell research. I have some doubts about this conclusion, because I think that the existence of this stem cell line in question, this is the stem cell line number 5 in this Chang paper, I have my doubts whether it really exists, because it's not registered in any international stem cell registry. And I also doubt about the real world applicability of this technology, because of course they removed a single blastomer from this 8 cell stage embryo, and they succeeded in preparing a human embryonic stem cell line from that. But what happened to the so-called parental embryo? What they did is they did freeze it away, so it may be there somehow in a freezing container. But the question is whether you can, in real world, you will find a woman who is willing to get it implanted in her uterus, and whether this is a technology which can be employed. IVF doctors are very skeptical about it. They oppose it because they say that the technology is possibly harmful to the embryo, and there's no indication for the embryo itself to doing this technology. So it could cause harm to the embryo, and so you shouldn't do it because there's no need to do that. And another reason is that at the 8-cell stage, some embryologists say that the single blastomeres could still be considered to be totipotent, so they must be equated to an embryo itself. I think as a conclusion, the EPO may appear to be using this method as a legal construct without sufficient technical basis, because there are no stem cell lines which are produced by this method which are currently used in international human embryonic stem cell research. And patents granted on the basis of this method could give adverse commercial incentives for the field of stem cell research in general. So my interpretation and conclusion, I now come to an end, is that the biotech patent law governance has returned to the administrative arena and to specialized national courts. And in my view, patent attorneys, patent examiners, and boards of appeal tried to escape these exclusions which were passed by the European legislator, and they undermine those legislatively fixed exclusions from patentability. In my conclusion, I think there's a silent, creeping, intransparent practice which is communicated only among insiders of the patent system. There's a lack of accountability to the European legislator, and the European Commission also seems to be willing to follow this path, instead of planning a new agenda setting for clarification in a legislative process where a democratically elected representative of the European people could have a say. So what's being done is kind of a reversal of those exclusions to patentability, and the patent law and the trajectories of patent law are dealt with within the epistemic community. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention.